Hello and welcome to Revolutionary Woman. My name is Tess Silverman. Women around the world are constantly creating ways to make a difference in their communities, and today's guest is no exception. Jacqueline Ackerman is director of the Women's Philanthropy Institute at the Indiana University Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. WPI believes that gender matters in philanthropy and that solving the world's complex problems requires perspective, leadership, and generosity from women and men. Jacqueline's work centers on moving the Institute's research into action, delivering insights to donors, fundraisers, and sector leaders that grow women's giving and deepen fundraisers' engagements with female donors. Over the last decade, Jacqueline has led WPI's research agenda, including serving as primary author on most of WPI's research reports. Jacqueline joined the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy in 2012 after earning a Master of Public Affairs from the Indiana University O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs in Bloomington. She was raised in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and resides in Bethesda, Maryland. Hi, Jacqueline. Welcome to Revolutionary Women. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for coming on the show. Okay, so I have a bunch of questions, so let's get started. Okay, so you grew up in Haiti from 3 months old before your family moved to Indiana, Kentucky, and then to Maryland, where you are now.
yes.
So first of all, what was it like growing up in Haiti, and what made your family move from Haiti?
Sure. Well, I actually entirely grew up in Haiti, and my parents retired from there. So they worked there for about 30, 31 years.
Oh, wow.
So, my entire childhood and then some. They were aid workers, missionaries. My dad ran medical clinics out in the country, and my mom raised us and then also taught at the international school that my sister and I went to.
Oh, okay.
And then I went to Indiana for college, and my family still lived in Haiti for a number of years after that. So my mom lives in Indiana now. Mm-hmm. I spent quite a long time there. That's where I connected with Indiana University for grad school. And then after I graduated from grad school, I started working at the School of Philanthropy and just never left. Okay. So, I was able to, thankfully, work remotely starting in about 2018 and moved to Louisville, Kentucky for a couple of years and have been in Bethesda, Maryland, kind of suburb of D.C. for the last 5 years. So see a lot of the world and a lot of the U.S. so far, too.
Okay. So you mentioned your parents were aid workers, missionaries. What lessons did you learn from them growing up?
Yeah, I love this question because especially at like the School of Philanthropy, the Women's Philanthropy Institute where I work, we ask a lot of people who their philanthropic role models were. And, women's philanthropy, a lot of people will say their mom or their grandma, but my philanthropic role model was actually my dad. Mm-hmm. And he really understood the concept of generosity and tithing, since he was religious and religiously motivated. Mm-hmm. And so he would always, no matter how much we were struggling financially, would set aside 10% of whatever we brought in to give away.
Wow.
And the other thing I loved was that he didn't just, give cash or checks to nonprofits or to the church. He did all of those things, but he would also, if someone came up to our gate and was asking for food, he mm-hmm. would make them a sandwich and sit down and talk with them. And, when one of our friends had, for example, a refrigerator breakdown, he mm-hmm. got them a new one. And so mm-hmm. it was all of those little things too. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I took away from my dad. And, he wasn't very highly educated. He came from rural Ohio and he just even though I'm in academia and I talk about these things kind of to academic audiences all the time, I just really love his example because he's kind of an example to me of how everyone can be philanthropic, no matter how kind of steeped in the research and the jargon you are.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's amazing, you know, especially having a father as your, as the person who inspired you to go into this work. And I think that's really awesome because you don't hear, I mean, usually when I speak with my guests, it's like, you know, a lot of the influences are not always, you know, fathers, it's usually mothers. So it's refreshing. And it's actually, it's refreshing to hear that your father was one of the main influences for you. To go into this work. So you lead the Women's Philanthropy Institute, which is part of the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at Indiana University. So you went to Indiana for college. So can you tell me how you got involved with them and what your role entails now?
Sure. I came to Indiana in part because that's where my parents had lived before they moved to Haiti. And so it's where their roots were. And so I ended up going for my undergrad, spent a few years working, and then went to graduate school in Indiana at IU Bloomington. They have a School of Public and Environmental Affairs. And I studied international development and international economic development, and then have, you know, been in the States studying philanthropic research and doing that research ever since. So a little bit of a you know, mismatch there, but the Women's Philanthropy Institute I was connected to once I started working at the Lilly Family School. So I, you know, was looking at graduation from grad school, had kind of looked all over the place, but a few things were keeping me in Indiana. And so one of my professors, Dr. Les Lankowski, he linked me up to Dr. Una Ofili on the Indianapolis campus, and she led research for the School of Philanthropy for many years and is still a faculty member at IU. And so she brought me on. I started working for the research department, kind of supporting research on all sorts of things related to philanthropy, and gradually migrated more and more over to the gender space, which was something I had really wanted to do anyway. And luckily there was funding for them to kind of bring me on full time. And then I've just kind of, I've had like five different titles within WPI. Okay. I've done everything, and now I'm the director of the institute at this time.
Wonderful. Okay. So I read that in 2015, one of your projects was focused on gender and philosophy with regards to philanthropy. So what was the result from that project? And I thought that was interesting because I never would have, you know, connected the two.
Sure. One of the really early studies I did with the Women's Philanthropy Institute was, it was essentially a literature review. And there wasn't a lot of, there was piecemeal research out there, but there wasn't a lot of cohesive field-wide summaries of where things stood. And so that was an important thing that kind of set us up to do some of the research that was missing, if you will, for the next 10 years. And just as an aside, we just published kind of a 10-year update of that literature review that kind of shows the growth of different areas of the field. And I'm really proud of all of our work and then all of the work that we influenced that's a part of that. But one thing that the original literature review asked was, you know, what are the trends for women and men's giving? Are there these gender differences in kind of the trends, the patterns, but are there also differences in why people give and kind of the psychology, the sociology that underlies that? Because if your listeners know about philanthropy, it is a kind of fledgling field, and the professors at our School of Philanthropy come from economics, sociology, psychology, history, and gender studies, all sorts of different avenues to, mm-hmm. to study philanthropy. And so we kind of took this broad view of it. And what I found interesting was that women tend to be more motivated to give through altruism or, you know, thinking about the end beneficiary of their generosity, not necessarily thinking about themselves. And men tend to give with a more self-interested mindset. And that sounds kind of blanket negative. So I do want to reassure everyone that, you know, giving for self-interested reasons can mean something as simple as I give in my backyard, I give to my local community, because ultimately, if my local community does better, then I will do better. So it can be anything like that. To, you know, maybe it is just for tax reasons and financial reasons. So that's kind of the interesting part for me. And then the other thing I was going to mention is who people look to as experts in philanthropy. And it's kind of depressing. The non-philanthropic research shows that men and women tend to pay more attention to men about any topic. But when it comes to philanthropy, especially women's philanthropy, especially giving to kind of gender issues, people are more likely to look to women for examples of that giving and then for information on how to do it and how to do it well.
Wow. That's interesting. Well, do you think culture or society and how women are perceived has anything to do with it?
Oh, yes. Okay. I think absolutely. There are so many really interesting studies. Alice Eagly is one researcher that has studied kind of really young children and their kind of pro-social, who's more likely to cry, who's more likely to show empathy in certain situations. And it's kind of wild to me that you can see that in very young children. And so perhaps there's some of this that's innate, but then you also see these huge gender differences as kids grow and kind of become part of adult society. And so I think there's absolutely something to how girls are raised and socialized. There's much more of a caretaking role that women are socialized into, and part of caretaking is being generous with your resources, whether those are financial or time or items, etc. So I absolutely think that there is a role for how folks are raised, and we also know that the country context matters a lot. Our research is mostly about generosity in the U.S. and gender differences here. But there are plenty of other researchers who are looking at this in other countries. And so there's some limited evidence that there are some of these gender differences in other countries. But, you know, generosity looks very different depending on where you are, the kind of legal framework. Here we have 501c3s, and we know what is tax deductible and what's not. Other countries have, you know, government involved NGOs that might be a little bit of a blurred line, if you will. And other countries may have just a different role for women in society, and so they may be more limited or in terms of what they can do in the public sector and how they can lead. So there are definitely these cultural influences, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so there are other philanthropic organizations like CARE International, Global Fund for Women, and Women for Women International. And UNICEF. So how does WPI differ from these organizations?
Yeah, WPI essentially is a research-oriented organization. So our primary product is research. These other nonprofits that you mentioned, their primary goal is, you know, provision of whether it's food, mm-hmm. education, care, mm-hmm. other tangibles. Mm-hmm. Our product is research. And so I kind of see that on like the very early side of things. It's not necessarily, you know, handing someone food mm-hmm. or providing someone directly with medical care, like on the front lines.
Right.
But what we do ideally is changing how nonprofit leaders are raising money mm-hmm. and how donors are giving. And so ideally our research is helping more funds get into the hands of those that need it so that they can provide that service. Right. And we are at Indiana University. We're technically part of this, you know, state education institution. Mm-hmm. That said, the Women's Philanthropy Institute is pretty small and has this very specific mission. And so I almost think of us as a small research-focused nonprofit think tank, if you will.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I like that because, I mean, the research you do, the results that you get from that can influence, like you said, mm-hmm. how these organizations, you know, give to the ones in need. Mm-hmm. But there's still a loss of balance or maybe inequity, mm-hmm. right, for those who are supposed to be getting these aids for women and children especially. How can your research help the way it should be funneled to the people who really need it, especially women mm-hmm. and girls?
I really appreciate you asking that question because I love talking about our research on giving to women's and girls' causes. Mm-hmm. When I joined the Women's Philanthropy Institute, our main focus in our research was looking at donors and how do women donors differ? What resources do women donors need in order to, you know, coordinate with nonprofits and kind of get what they need from their giving? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, a couple of years into my tenure, we were able to add on a major arm of our research looking at giving to women's and girls' causes. And one of the issues there is, you know, a lot of women give to women and girls' causes. The most likely donor to a women's or girls' focused organization is a woman. And mm-hmm. so we got asked a lot, you know, oh, is this growing? We feel like giving to women and girls is growing. And it's like, well, yes, mm-hmm. that is a feeling. And there are no facts out there about that right now. Mm-hmm. And so in 2019, we created what's known as the Women and Girls Index. Mm-hmm. And so we've updated it every year since. We just put out new numbers last week. And so that essentially measures the total amount of charitable giving going to women's and girls organizations in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in 2019, we showed that the dollars going to women's and girls organizations were about 1.7% of total charitable giving, which mm-hmm. is very dismal.
Yeah,
And, you know, we had said less than 2% for many, many years. And wow. So finally, this last week, I was able to say, you know, we have hit 2%. We've kind of barely hit it. We're not hitting it out of the park. We're not at like 10% or anything. But right. we have shown that this can be increased because you don't know how to increase something if mm-hmm. you can't measure it. You don't know what's actually happening. You just have anecdotes. And right. so right. It's kind of shown us that these numbers can change and they are able to be changed with kind of awareness and a concerted effort.
Right. And awareness is huge, I would think, because mm-hmm. how would you know unless you had numbers in front of you and they really mean a lot if it's tangible?
Yes.
So you can't dismiss it if it's like the numbers are the numbers, right? So
mm-hmm. Exactly. You can't say, oh, women and girls are getting so much philanthropy if it's like, no, literally we are in the low single digits. We are not kind of taking over most of philanthropy.
Right. And that's really crazy, you know, mm-hmm. especially since you're talking about, you know, families who are, I mean, a lot of them are headed by women, are the ones exactly. who are taking care of the children. You know, and a lot of times they can't make do unless they have, you know, help. So, and do you find that, I know it's your product, this research, but do you see also what the correlation is of having men as allies?
We haven't, you know, measured that in research, but in our experience, it is extremely important, if not, you know, necessary.
Right.
Women can kind of speak up for themselves right. all they want, but until things are actually equitable, we do need the men in power to, you know, share, cede power, and to talk with their fellow men about how to do that in a way that benefits everybody. And so there are some great organizations, like A Call to Men, and there are just a number of men working in this field who are really great examples of that. But I would say, yes, that's absolutely necessary. It's a lot harder to write off a movement when someone who looks like you and has your background and your experiences is telling you, no, I agree with them, and this does need to change.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, so can you mention a time when you thought you needed to do something that would affect your life and others?
Yeah, I took on leadership of the Women's Philanthropy Institute a little over a year and a half ago. My predecessor, Jeannie Sager, who was amazing and the best boss I've ever had, she left for another role. And so I first took on leadership of the Women's Philanthropy Institute in an interim capacity and now formally. And that was a big decision. It was easy to say yes to because I knew that it was the right thing at the right time and in a really important moment for the Institute. But I also knew it would be a stretch. And so that's the main one I can think of. It's overall been a great experience. I'm glad that I can kind of be the figurehead who can amplify the research, advocate for a more equitable philanthropic sector, but it's certainly been a moment of growth for me as well.
Okay, so I actually went on your site and I love this quote. To unlock the full potential of women's philanthropy, we must understand how gender shapes giving behavior. To build a powerful and diverse force of female philanthropists, we need to understand more about what drives women to give. So as the director, how has that changed the way you look at philanthropy?
I think for me, I have been able to take a longer term view of philanthropy, if you will. One of the main things that we talk about when we talk about women donors kind of coming into their wealth and their power and using it to affect the causes that, that they care about is a thing called the Great Wealth Transfer, where essentially, you know, boomers and older folks are passing down money to Gen Xers, but also a lot of millennials, Gen Z, and a lot of that is going to benefit women because women do tend to inherit twice from spouses and from parents or older generations. And so, you know, I think it's been a rough year or so for a lot of folks in philanthropy, and especially in philanthropy geared toward women and girls or gender issues or any sort of identity issues. And so it's really easy to say, oh, this is terrible and I don't know what we're gonna do. And that's all very legitimate. It is a disturbing time. It is a challenging time. But if you think about what philanthropy is gonna look like in 10 years or in 20 years, we know that so many more dollars, trillions and trillions of dollars, are going to be in women's hands. Many of them for the first time having this financial power. And we know that women having more money means more going to philanthropy, and it means more going to women's and girls' causes. So that's kind of what I have been able to think about with this great wealth transfer. Is it's really a sea change in how philanthropy is going to be done. We've been kind of preaching for 10, 20 years about, you know, you really should pay attention to women donors. Women donors give in unique ways. You can't just fundraise from them like you have been fundraising from, let's say, their husbands or their fathers for decades. And, you know, a lot of people will take it to heart, but some are like, oh, that's really nice to know. We're going to keep doing what we're doing. You know, in 10 years and 20 years, that's just not going to be the status quo. It's not going to be acceptable, and it's not going to work.
Thank you for that. Okay, so what's next for Jacqueline?
Well, I think in a professional capacity, I am, you know, enjoying and really getting a lot of value out of leading in philanthropy, leading in women's issues, especially. My favorite things to do as director are partnerships and moving research to practice. So I really enjoy just, you know, talking to other people, figuring out how our work can support them, and representing the Institute to audiences, both that really know our stuff and want to dig in deep, and also people who have never heard that women are more generous than men in all of these different ways. So that's what I really enjoy. You know, personally, I think we're all, to a certain extent, trying to find that right work-life balance. And so that's kind of where I am right now. I live in this great area, in the DC area, have so much, you know, culture available to me, have so many friends in the area. I have two wonderful dogs, and it's, you know, it's a matter of how much time am I taking to actually invest in those things and those relationships and in my kind of personal growth and interests outside of the office. So those are kind of my dual goals, is to keep doing what I'm doing and do more of it, and also balance it with the other things that matter.
Okay. So is there anything you would like to say to my listeners?
I think that a lot of people hear the word philanthropy or philanthropist, and they don't identify with it. It doesn't resonate for them, which is why I try to use the word generosity or giving. But we hope at the Women's Philanthropy Institute, we hope that people start to kind of take back the word. We define philanthropy as, yes, giving dollars, but also giving time. If you volunteer, even like at your kid's school or at your house of worship, you know, that's giving time. If you say, well, I can't give, but I have five friends who might be interested in this cause, and I'm going to tell them about it, giving your kind of voice, your network, your reach. There are so many ways to be generous, and you don't have to be wealthy to do it. And you can even give a small amount, you know, $10 a month, $20 a month, and it still matters to an organization, especially smaller organizations. And so I just would want people to take away that philanthropy is for everyone. If you don't like the word, you don't have to use the word. But just know that you can own it if you want to. And that generosity is really important, and it brings our communities together. And there are so many different ways to do it, that there's no single person who can't be generous in some way.
No, you're right. So if anyone wanted to know more about you and the Women's Philanthropy Institute, how would they go about it?
They can go to our website or our social media. We are especially active on LinkedIn.
So if you had one thing to change that you wish you had done years ago, would there be one thing?
You know, I think everything that has happened leads you to where you are. And I really love what my life looks like today. So I can't really say that, you know, I wish I could do a lot of things differently that would change where I am today. Mm-hmm. That said, when I was younger, you know, early, mid-20s, I really had a lot of self-doubt, imposter syndrome. And that's in my career and personally, you know, just feeling like I couldn't choose what I wanted. I needed to take what I was given and be happy with it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes I still do struggle with that. It took me a while to internalize that I belong where I am professionally. Mm-hmm. I am a leader. I don't have to try to be a leader. I am. I have a voice that matters. Yeah. And what I say can make a difference. So, you know, I was a lot quieter 10 years ago, and I've gotten a little bit louder and more verbose, but I also am happier about that now.
That's awesome. And my last question is, if you could go back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
You may want to edit this out, but I would say don't get married at 21. So I think, and that leads me to kind of personally and professionally, trust your instincts. If you think that something is the right way to go or the wrong way to go, listen to that, dig into that. You don't have to jump right away. Advocate for yourself. No one is going to advocate for you better than yourself. Right. And don't be small. Don't be afraid to take up space. And you know, just, I would love to tell myself that, you know, 25, 28 year old Jackie, the work that she is doing really matters. Mm. And that she actually is really smart and does really belong in leadership and is going to get there, and maybe free myself from a little bit of that imposter syndrome I had to grow through.
I love it. Well, Jackie, thank you so much for coming on my show and for sharing your life and your work with me and my listeners. I love what Women's Philanthropy Institute is all about. I love when I learn something different, you know, about something I've never even thought of. So, you know, looking at your site and finding out, you know, more about what Women's Philanthropy Institute does really changes my perception about giving, you know, whether it's through philanthropy or just by giving, like you said, your time, your talent, or finances. But so thank you for saying yes to this, because it's really made me aware of like what else I can be doing, you know, other than what I'm doing now. So I love what your mission is. You know, good luck with your future projects, and please keep me posted with whatever will be going on in the future.
Thank you so much. It was really nice talking to you.
Thank you. You as well. Have a great day, and I will catch up with you soon. Okay. Thanks. Bye. That's our show for today. I've posted more information about Jacqueline Ackerman on RevWomen.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll tune in every other Thursday for another episode of Revolutionary Women. You can listen to Revolutionary Women on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Just a little note. I've launched a Patreon account to support the show. All proceeds will go to producing and editing the episodes to give my poor husband a break for being my personal IT and production department. He wrote this. The address is patreon.com/revwoman.